Time servers and careerists had been weeded out in favor of younger, more energetic officers. It was a difficult and expensive process, but Vilk was convinced that it was working. Together with their CIDs, the Alliance's conventional ground forces were now strong enough to stop an offensive by Russia's tank and motorized rifle divisions. In the air, the combination of upgraded Polish and Romanian F-16s and Hungary's JAS-39 Gripens, working in tandem with Iron Wolf's stealthy MQ-35 Coyote drone missile launchers and Scion's other high-tech weapons, stood an excellent chance of blunting raids by Russia's fighters and bombers. The same held true for any new cyber war campaign orchestrated by Moscow. Since the last onslaught, the Alliance had steadily strengthened its defenses against computer hacking and destructive malware. The Hungarian sighed.
I only wish the costs were not so high, Pyotr, he said. He looked pained.
Every new defense bill draws more and more opposition in my country's National Assembly.
Vilk nodded somberly. He faced the same political difficulties. Even after two Russian attacks on Poland, there were still some members of the opposition parties who fought him tooth and nail for every zloty for national defense.
Well, I think it's better to spend money now than spend lives and risk our freedoms later, he said quietly.
Grudgingly, Lukács acknowledged the power of his argument.
At least I've convinced you that we can hold our own against Moscow, Vilk thought, looking at the Hungarian.
Then why am I still so worried?
Much later that evening, after a dinner and reception in honor of the ranking political and military leaders attending the exercises, Vilk finally got the chance to pose that same question to some of his closest advisors. They were gathered in his hotel suite in Szczecin, 80 kilometers west of Drawsko-Pomorski. He looked carefully around the sitting room, taking each of the attendees in. First, Kevin Martindale, looking smooth and well-polished as always, in an elegant black dinner jacket and bow tie. Next, Major Nadia Rozek, his former military aide, in her dress uniform, as an officer in Poland's special forces, and finally Captain Brad McClanahan, tall, broad-shouldered, and blonde-haired. The young American wore the dark rifle-green uniform jacket, collared shirt, and black tie of the Iron Wolf Squadron. A patch on his shoulder showed a military-gray robotic wolf's head, with glowing red eyes on a bright green background.
You're right, Pyotr,
Martindale said, after listening to Vilk's concerns. We are missing something. My Scion intelligence analysts have been picking up signs of unusual activity involving Russia's most elite Spetsnaz and combat aviation units, but I'll be damned if I can make the pieces fit together into anything that makes sense. Suddenly intent and focused, Brad leaned forward. What kind of activity? Like they're moving to higher readiness? Getting ready to take another crack at us? That's what's strange, Martindale said, shaking his head. As far as my people can tell from very limited data, these units are not training for a renewed war. If anything, it looks as if their preparedness is actually slipping.
Nadia frowned.
Slipping? In what way?
For one thing, a significant number of previously scheduled maneuvers have been abruptly canceled,
Martindale told her. Regular tank and motorized rifle brigades don't seem to be affected, but it doesn't appear as though any Spetsnaz unit has conducted serious combat training for several months. And now, over the past few weeks, we've seen the same pattern with those fighter units equipped with top-of-the-line interceptors like the Su-35 and Su-50. Suddenly, they're not engaging in any air-to-air combat exercises or even flying routine patrols. Perplexed, Vilk shook his head. The former American president was right. This was very odd. Maintaining air-to-air combat skills required constant effort. Fighter pilots left sitting on the ground, even with access to advanced flight simulators, soon lost their edge. The same thing went for the specialized skills needed by Spetsnaz teams. But why would Gennady Gryzlov suddenly pull the plug on training for his best troops and pilots?
We've also lost track of some key personnel in those units, Martindale went on. Either because they've been reassigned somewhere we don't know about, or because they're being demobilized.
Brad snorted.
Demobilized? I wouldn't bet on that. Gryzlov's not the kind of guy who'd let his best people just walk away. No, that Russian son of a bitch is up to something, all right. He grimaced. But like Mr. Martindale over there, I'm damned if I can put my finger on what it might be.
Nadia's blue-gray eyes darkened.
I really do not care for the idea of just sitting around waiting to find out the hard way what Moscow has up its sleeve.
Nor do I, Major, Vilk assured her. He turned to Martindale. I assume you have a plan to remedy our ignorance, and probably one that is both highly dangerous and of questionable legality.
A wry grin flashed across the former American president's face.
I see that my reputation precedes me. He leaned back in his chair. But yes, I do, Pyotr. In fact, I've already set a covert op in motion.
Without my authorization, Vilk said flatly.
There were moments when it became clear that even though his private military company was employed by Poland, Martindale viewed himself as an independent actor on the world stage.
Correct, the other man shrugged. This is strictly a Cyan-initiated intelligence-gathering operation, not an AFN or Polish-ordered action. If it goes badly, that might give your government a modest amount of diplomatic cover.
And why, precisely, would we need such protection?
Vilk asked coolly.
Because I'm sending a team of my best operatives deep inside Russia to get some answers, Martindale replied. And try as they might, I suspect they're not likely to end up being very subtle about it.
Which means the odds are this team of yours is going to need a fast ride out, Brad guessed.
So that is why you're telling us about this mission now, rather than simply reporting its results later, Nadia said. Her tone was cold.
Martindale nodded.
Quite true, Major Rozhik. I may need help from the Iron Wolf Squadron to extract my agents.
Brad sighed. I suppose you want us to warm up the XCV-62 Ranger? He didn't sound especially eager, and Vilk could not blame him. The younger McClanahan and Nadia had flown the Ranger, a stealthy, short takeoff and landing tactical airlifter, on the raid against Russia's Perun Eri cyberwar complex. Two members of their 9-person assault team had been killed, and another seriously wounded. While the survivors had escaped through a tightly drawn net of Russian interceptors and SAMs, it was only by the narrowest of margins.
Not this time, Martindale said, shaking his head. The Ranger's a highly capable machine, but the area my people are going to be operating in probably won't offer any decent landing zones big enough to accommodate an aircraft of its size. He turned to Nadia, eyeing the Silver Eagle's pilot badge on her uniform.
No, for this mission, I have something a bit more mundane in mind.
7. Reagan Air Freight Facility, Indianapolis International Airport, Indianapolis, Indiana. That same time. Sited just 7 miles from the estate capital and near the junction of 7 major interstate highways, Indianapolis International Airport was the 8th busiest air freight hub in the United States. More than 1 million metric tons of cargo flowed through its distribution centers and adjoining warehouses every year. So when Francis Xavier Reagan expanded his namesake Reagan Air Freight's operations into the American market, it made perfect sense to choose Indianapolis as its new corporate headquarters. In the months since the reclusive billionaire sold his interest and vanished at sea, Reagan Air's top executives had carried on managing the company's day-to-day operations without much interference or even guidance from the new owners. At first, they'd all agreed that it felt peculiar to be out from under the old man's cold and ever-calculating eye. Gradually, though, CEO Martin Crown and his closest subordinates had begun enjoying their unanticipated freedom of action. For the first time in their tenure with the company, they felt fully in charge. Now, Crown thought dourly, it looked very much like these short-lived glory days of power and total control were coming to an end. Together with his chief financial officer, Halsey Stutz, and their director of flight operations, Ted Locke, he'd been invited out to the airport to watch Reagan Air's newest acquisition, a Boeing 737-200F freighter, arrive. Sweating profusely in the heat rolling off the tarmac, the big, paunchy American unbuttoned his suit jacket. He glanced at the shorter, slimmer man who'd summoned them here, out of their comfortable air-conditioned offices. This guy Daneker was their liaison with the new owners, all of whom were based overseas. He also had the lean, hungry look Crown associated with men who didn't mind being the bearers of bad tidings, like mass layoffs or poorly conceived corporate restructurings that usually ended in bankruptcy.
"There it comes," Daneker said suddenly. pointing to the twin-engine narrow-body jet, flaring in to land on runway 5L about a mile and a half from their position, in front of Reagan Air's shipment center. The air freighter was already painted in Reagan's trademark Kelly green and gold stripes, with a large stylized R on its tail fin. The Swiss checked his watch.
"Precisely on schedule," he said with satisfaction.
Crown exchanged a pained look with Stutz and Locke. Given their current state of the economy, none of them would have approved buying another aircraft, let alone a model so old and outdated. After all, the last 737-200 had rolled off Boeing's production line more than 30 years ago, and out of more than 1,000 built, fewer than 100 were still flying. Daneker smiled politely, seeing their expressions.
"Do not worry, gentlemen. We negotiated a very good price when purchasing this aircraft from its former owners, and though it may be old, it is still in good flying condition."
Crown merely nodded, this time working harder to hide his dismay. Like most people without aviation industry experience, Daneker obviously believed the upfront purchase price for an aircraft was what mattered most, but that was peanuts in the bigger scheme of things. What really counted was how much the plane cost to maintain and operate over time. And on that score, he was pretty sure this 737-200F was going to prove a massive headache. Compared to newer jets, it was a fuel hog. Besides that, keeping the damned antiquated thing flying was going to soak up precious maintenance hours that would have been far better spent on more efficient aircraft. Hell, he was willing to bet that the guys at the regional Chinese airline that used to fly this hunk of junk couldn't believe their luck when they were offered more than the scrap metal price. Engines whining shrilly, the cargo jet taxied off the runway and over toward them. As the jet rolled to a stop, Ted Locke leaned in closer to Crown.
"Jesus Christ, Martin," he murmured. "They've put a freaking gravel kit on this bird."
Crown nodded, seeing the telltale gravel deflector shaped like a wide ski attached to the 737's nose wheel, and the long, thin vortex dissipators mounted in front of both engines. By protecting the engines from debris kicked up on takeoffs and landings, gravel kits allowed aircraft to use shorter, unpaved runways. In its early days, Reagan Air Freight had equipped some of its planes with the same kind of kits so they could fly into rural airfields in Alaska and the wilds of northern Canada. But over time, those routes proved totally uneconomical and were dropped. He scowled. Just what were the new owners planning? Invited by Daneker to inspect the aircraft more closely, Crown and his team soon realized the gravel kit was the least of its modifications. The 737's forward main cargo door was now much larger than that of any standard model. Not only that, but the door had been completely reconfigured so that it would slide smoothly back along the fuselage, rather than pop open. In addition, the freighter's main deck now featured a high-speed overhead cargo handling mechanism and guide rails slotted into the floor.
"What's the game here, Mr. Daneker?"
Crown demanded when they finished walking through the heavily modified cargo jet.
"None of these fancy new gizmos is of any real use in our current lines of business."
"That is quite true," the other man said blandly. "But since the company's owners plan to use this aircraft to explore a new business opportunity, it is also immaterial."
"What new opportunity?" Halsey Stutz asked with a sharp edge in his voice. As Reagan Air Freight's chief financial officer, he spent a lot of time hunting for ways to improve the company's efficiency and market share. Clearly, he found the idea that he'd missed something obvious insulting. Daneker offered him a conciliatory smile.
"One quite far afield from your current operations, Mr. Stutz, and somewhat untested."
"Untested? How?"
"Your company's new owners are interested in ferrying equipment, parts, and supplies to oil and gas fracking operations and wind turbine and solar power installations in remote parts of the United States, Canada, and Mexico," Daneker said. "They believe there is money to be made out of these new green energy industries. Significant amounts of money. In fact, I believe they have already recruited a small number of experts who will soon arrive to staff a new division within your company."
Stutz looked even more worried.
"With respect, Mr. Daneker, where on earth do you think the money's going to come from to pay for this new venture of theirs? We're in a very competitive industry here, and practically every dollar we make is already fully committed. There is absolutely no way we can expand into a risky new field right now. Not if we want to stay profitable.
Relax, gentlemen, Daneker said, still smiling calmly. You need not worry about the costs. The owners fully understand Reagan Air's current financial constraints. They assure me they will fund this experimental endeavor out of their own resources, rather than using profits from your current operations.
For the first time since the Swiss banker appeared in his office, Martin Crown allowed himself to relax a bit. He could tell the others had the same reaction. If the people who'd bought out old Francis Xavier Reagan wanted to risk even more of their own money, more power to them. If nothing else, playing around with this wacky idea of supplying the air freight needs of green energy projects might keep them busy and out of his hair. And if they actually managed to turn a profit at it, well, so much the better. Facing competition from rivals like FedEx, UPS, and DHL, Reagan Air could use every extra dollar it could rustle up. Standing in the open forward cargo door of the 737-200F, Willem Daneker watched the American business executives drive away. Gennady Grislov had chosen wisely in buying this company, he realized. Its executives and employees were used to accommodating Reagan's sudden whims and top-down style of leadership. That rendered them easier to manipulate and less curious about matters they saw as outside their immediate responsibilities.
"Do you have new instructions for us, Herr Daneker?"
A lightly accented voice said behind him. He turned around. The 737's pilot, a stocky, fit-looking man in his 40s, stood in the door leading to the cockpit.
"No, Colonel Anyenkov, I do not. Moscow's original orders stand. Once you're refueled, you will proceed to the Grand County Airport outside Moab in the American state of Utah and await further orders."
Colonel Yuri Anyenkov nodded.
"Я понимаю. I understand."
The former Russian Air Force officer now worked for Major General Karaykin's private military company, RKU. His passport and other documents, like those of the other flight crew aboard, identified him as a German national employed by Reagan Air Freight. Under close scrutiny by American law enforcement or intelligence agencies, it was unlikely their cover stories would hold up. Fortunately, Daneker knew, not such scrutiny was likely as long as they stayed safely aboard their aircraft or inside the newly fenced-in perimeter at the Moab base. John D. Farrell Presidential Campaign Rally. Erie Insurance Arena, Erie, Pennsylvania. A short time later. Tall, with broad shoulders and powerful arms, he'd first developed working on oil rigs and now kept through rigorous exercise. John Dalton Farrell strode right out in front of the podium as he came to the finish of his stump speech.
"And so, friends, I say, may God bless the United States of America. Now, let's get to work. Let's get this great nation of ours moving again."
With a deafening roar of enthusiasm, the 8,000 people crowding the arena were on their feet, chanting in unison and waving campaign signs and flags. Smiling broadly, Farrell took the brown Stetson cowboy hat handed him by an aide and swung it in lazy circles in the air above his head. The clamor rose even higher. His big, open-hearted smile turned into a wide, toothy grin. Early on in his presidential bid, some high-priced political consultant had tried to dissuade him from wearing that hat in public, arguing that it was too stereotypically Texan.
"Hell, son," Farrell had retorted, "I am from Texas. You hear that drawl? There's no hiding where I'm from, so I might as well make it work for me."
Like most of the gambles he'd taken throughout his life, this one had paid off. After nearly 4 years of increasingly bureaucratic rule by buttoned-down Washington insiders, people were hungry for a candidate who seemed fresh, alive, and genuine. A candidate who wasn't afraid to break stale old political rules. With a final wave to the shouting, cheering, foot-stomping crowd, Farrell clapped his cowboy hat firmly back onto his head. Making sure to shake every hand he could reach, he left the stage and passed through doors into a hallway that led out back, where his motorcade was waiting. His security detail closed in on all sides. As soon as they stepped outside into the warm, humid evening, a throng of reporters mobbed him, yelling questions in his direction. Bright Klieg lights lit the scene. Cameras clicked and whirred. Farrell held up a hand.
"I'm real sorry, ladies and gentlemen," he grinned at them.
Ordinarily, I love talking with y'all, but right now my security folks tell me we've got to get a move on.
A young blonde-haired woman wearing a CNN press badge elbowed her way out of the crowd.
That's my question, Governor. Who are all these powerful security people of yours exactly? They're not members of the Secret Service.
Why not? Surely as the nominee of your party, you're entitled to Secret Service protection.
Farrell shook his head.
I hate to correct you, ma'am, but I am not yet the nominee. That won't come until we hold our convention in 2 weeks.
Isn't that just a formality?
Another journalist asked.
You've got the delegates you need to win sewed up.
Maybe so, but I learned a hard lesson after drilling my first dry hole.
Farrell said,
there's no such thing as sewed up in life.
He grinned again.
Except if you wave a bunch of taxpayer dollars in front of corporate big fish, they're guaranteed to cut you a nice fat campaign check.
That drew laughter.
And President Barbeau's sure got that routine down cold,
he added. This time his quip drew a mix of pained laughter and sour looks. No surprise there, Farrell thought in amusement. Most of the press corps were not so subtly rooting for Stacey Ann Barbeau. Their slant was something he had to factor into every political calculation he made. At least in this day and age, between the internet and other new media, he had more ways to get his message to the voters without running headlong into their ideological buzzsaw.
Anyway, he said, I don't plan on using the Secret Service for protection even if I win the nomination.
And why is that? The CNN reporter pounced. Don't you trust them?
I've no doubts at all about the professionalism of the Secret Service,
Farrell said patiently.
But I'm not in this race to cost the taxpayers even more of their hard-earned dollars. So I'm sticking with the folks I've brought to this dance, a collection of fine men and women from the Texas Capitol Police and the Texas Rangers, together with several decorated veterans of our nation's armed forces.
He nodded at the grizzled, tough-looking man standing next to him.
Men like Sergeant Davis here.
Former U.S. Special Forces Sergeant Andrew Davis looked pained. Years of covert fieldwork for the Army, and later for Cyan and the Iron Wolf Squadron, had taught him to avoid the limelight, not to relish it.
But those Rangers and Capitol Police officers are paid by your state's taxpayers, aren't they?
The woman, CNN reporter, said with an audible sneer.
So isn't this just a PR stunt?
No, ma'am,
Farrell said politely, with just the barest hint of an edge to his voice.
As it happens, I'm reimbursing the good people of Texas out of my own pocket. When I'm not conducting official business in my own state, nothing I do costs any Texan one red cent. Unlike some candidates, I pay my own freight.
He donned another wide grin and doffed his hat to her.
You know, the country might be better off if more politicians did the same.
With that parting shot, he climbed into the big black SUV idling at the curb and waited while Andrew Davis took the jump seat across from him. The doors slammed shut, and they pulled away, followed by several more SUVs carrying his staff and the rest of his security detail. Farrell sighed and closed his eyes briefly.
Good God, he muttered. What a snarling, snapping pack of hyenas.
Comes with the turf, Governor, Davis said unsympathetically. Nobody forced you into politics, did they?
Nope,
Farrell admitted with a self-deprecating smile.
That was all my own big damned ego at work,
he looked at the other man.
Sorry about turning the spotlight on you back there, Sergeant. I know that's not real comfortable for you.
Davis shrugged.
Like I said, it comes with this turf.
With a grimace, he shifted in his seat.
I figure not many people would think having their picture taken was rougher than getting shot at by the Russians or some other goons.
Farrell nodded. Davis had been invalided out of the Iron Wolf Squadron after being badly wounded in a raid on Russia's cyber war complex. After months of intensive physical therapy, the veteran Special Forces non-com had recovered enough to find himself bored as hell in civilian life. He and Farrell were from the same part of rural Texas, and when mutual acquaintances suggested Davis would be a good fit for his campaign security team, Farrell had jumped at the chance to bring him on board.
Do you miss it?
He asked seriously.
Fighting for the polls and Cyan?
Do you miss wildcatting?
Davis asked him in return. Farrell thought about that, remembering the sheer thrill involved in staking every penny he had on the chance of striking oil in desolate places conventional geologists had already ruled out.
Sometimes, he admitted, But then I figured that shooting for the presidency is a pretty big gamble all on its own. And God knows this country needs someone better than Stacey Ann Barbeau and her crowd running things.
Davis raised an eyebrow. And you figure you're that someone better?
Farrell shrugged with a wry half-smile.
I do.
There haven't been many really good presidents,
the other man said meditatively.
Washington, Lincoln, Reagan, maybe a few more.
You seriously think I'm on that level?
Farrell asked, still smiling ironically.
Davis shook his head. With all due respect, Governor, hell no.
Then why exactly are you working for me?
Farrell wondered.
Since I'm a miserly son of a bitch, I sure as hell know it's not the pay.
Not hardly,
Davis agreed with a snort. He grinned.
Mostly, I guess, it's because you're smart enough to hire guys like me who will tell you straight out when you start sounding like you're full of shit.
Laughing now, Farrell tipped his hat in salute, and then sat back to enjoy the rest of the ride to the airport. 8. RKU Special Weapons Exercise Area in the Kuznetsky-Alatau Mountain Range, Siberia, Russia. The next day. More than 200 kilometers east of Novosibirsk, rugged stream-cut foothills rose higher and higher, climbing steadily toward the iron, manganese, and gold-rich slopes of the Kuznetsky-Alatau Mountains. Dense fir and pine forests covered most of the region. Digital and paper maps showed only a handful of dirt roads, mostly used by logging companies cutting local timber. Those maps were out of date. For several months, troops from the Russian Army's 60th Engineer Regiment had labored under enormously long stretches of carefully erected camouflage netting to cut and pave a new road through the woods. Wide enough for heavy trucks, this concealed thoroughfare tied into the P-225 Novosibirsk-Irkutsk Highway. It ended at a new top-secret military training area set aside for use by RKU's Kibernetskaya Voinenia Mashini, its cybernetic warfare machines. Flanked by his bodyguards, Gennady Grizlov left the half-buried concrete bunker that had kept him safe during a recently completed live-fire exercise. His eyes gleamed with excitement and pleasure. Years of carefully laid plans were coming to fruition. Russia's first operational KVMs had all the mobility and firepower their designer, Dr. Mikhail Aronov, had promised and more. Quickly, Grizlov strode off along a winding footpath, savoring the sight of burned-out armored vehicles and explosion-shattered mock buildings scattered through the nearby woods and clearings. Soldiers scurried in all directions, putting out fires. Others scrambled to drag new camouflage panels over wrecked vehicles and ruined structures, hopefully hiding them from satellite view. Abruptly, a voice blared out from concealed loudspeakers.
Preduprezhdeniya! Preduprezhdeniya! Warning! Warning! The next hostile satellite pass will occur in 13 minutes. Repeat, the next satellite pass will occur in 13 minutes. Expedite all pre-planned concealment operations.
His pleasure momentarily derailed, Grizlov scowled. This continuing need to hide their activities from America's spy satellites was an unwelcome reminder that he did not yet fully control all of Russia's frontiers. The day must come, he thought coldly, when his country dominated both the world and the cold, dark vacuum of space around it. Nothing less would do. The sight of one of the KVMs stationed beside the path restored his good humor. Lean and lethal-looking, the war robot towered over Vladimir Kraikin and Dr. Aronov. Bulky weapons packs were attached at various points around its long torso. From his emphatic gestures, the portly professor of cybernetics was explaining something to Kraikin. Both men stiffened to attention when Grizlov joined them.
"My congratulations on a successful training exercise, gentlemen," he said easily. "But carry on. Don't let me interrupt you."
"Yes, Mr. President," Aronov stammered. "I was just discussing proposed weapons loadouts with Mr. Kraikin."
"And what have you decided?" Grizlov asked.
"That the guns and missiles carried by our KVMs must be tailored precisely to each planned mission," Kraikin said. He tapped the dull gray metal and ceramic leg of the robot beside him. "As powerful as these machines are,
They have limitations.
It's mostly a question of battery power and volume, sir,
Aronov explained apologetically.
The more weapons and ammunition a KVM carries, the more power it consumes when moving. Excessive weight will greatly reduce their effective combat range. And autocannons, anti-tank missiles, and the like are all quite bulky. We only have room to carry so many of them at one time.
Grislov nodded his understanding. He'd been fully briefed on the weapon systems Karaikin had selected to equip RKU's combat robot force, while Russia's scientists and engineers had not yet been able to recreate the remarkable electromagnetic railguns used by Martindale's CIDs, their own fighting machines would still be able to bring a deadly assortment of armament to bear in any battle. For heavy firepower, each fighting machine would employ a massive Russian-made GSH-31 30mm autocannon. Used by fighter and ground attack aircraft, it was an extremely powerful and accurate weapon. As a plus, the GSH-31 was in service with more than 20 countries around the world, many of them third-world nations with notoriously lax control over their armaments stockpiles. Directly tying the use of these autocannons to Russia itself would be a difficult task for any investigator. The same thing applied to the other weapons Karaikin had chosen. For example, on missions that might involve contact with enemy armored forces, each KVM would carry up to 3 Israeli-made Spike fire-and-forget anti-tank missiles. More than 2 dozen nations had those missiles in their inventory. Best of all, they were also used by Poland's mercenary Iron Wolf Squadron. Grislov allowed himself a quick, predatory smile at that thought, imagining Martindale and that Polish piece of shit Vilk desperately claiming their robots weren't responsible for the havoc Karaikin's KVMs were about to wreak.
"Very well, Dr. Aronov," he said. "Make sure all the pilots, unit commanders, and technicians understand exactly what these machines can and cannot do."
"Yes, Mr. President."
Grislov turned to Karaikin.
"Are your plans to infiltrate the combat robot force complete?"
Karaikin nodded confidently.
"They are, sir."
Again, he patted the robot looming above him.
"Thanks to Dr. Aronov's cleverness, each KVM is completely modular. They can be broken down into their separate components, all of which are easily concealed inside shipments of heavy machinery, especially the kind of machinery used in power plants and other energy industry facilities. Once at their final destination, the robots can be reassembled in a matter of hours."
Grislov smiled.
"It's fortunate that a Russian-owned firm routinely exports such equipment to Mexico, is it not?"
Karaikin shot him an answering smile.
"Fortunate indeed, Mr. President.
Otlichnaya robota."
"Excellent work," Grislov said.
"You are authorized to begin shipping your KVMs immediately. I want them ready for action as soon as possible."
While Karaikin hurried away to issue the necessary orders to his pilots and technicians, Grislov turned back toward a camouflage landing pad built behind the observation bunker. Once the American spy satellite completed its pass over this area, his light Ansat U helicopter could safely depart. A nondescript private jet stood by at Novosibirsk for the longer flight back to Moscow. With luck, no one outside his inner circle would ever realize he'd been gone. To his surprise and irritation, Aronov tagged along with him.
"You have something else to report, Doctor?"
he asked.
"I've already read all of your technical assessments of these robots. Is there some new development I should know about?"
"It's not so much an assessment of the KVMs themselves,"
the professor said, hesitating a bit.
"More a concern about possible psychological effects their pilots could experience."
"Go on,"
Grislov said with deceptive mildness. Aronov swallowed hard.
"I'm worried that prolonged operation of these powerful machines, especially the mental and physical isolation involved when connected to their neural interfaces, might give pilots a dangerous sense of almost superhuman invulnerability. If so, the consequences..."
Grislov cut him off with a dismissive offhand gesture.
"War is not a place for weaklings, Aronov," he said. "These men have already proven themselves in high-performance fighter aircraft, under maximum stress while pulling high Gs. Compared to that,
Running around in those metal suits of yours will be like a stroll in the park.
9. Headquarters, 22nd Guard Spetsnaz Brigade, Batayask near Rostov-on-Don, Russia. A few days later. Russia's 22nd Guard Spetsnaz Brigade was based on the eastern outskirts of the little city of Batayask, roughly 10 kilometers south of the much larger city of Rostov-on-Don. The Taganrog Gulf, the northeastern tip of the Sea of Azov, lay about 40 kilometers due west. The Spetsnaz compound contained troop barracks, vehicle parks, a parade ground, indoor close combat training ranges, and a large two-story headquarters building. Outside its wooded perimeter, the surrounding streets were lined with old Soviet-era concrete apartment blocks, a few grocery stores and pharmacies, and a couple of light manufacturing and aircraft repair plants. Late in the afternoon, a green UAZ-3163 Patriot SUV pulled up in front of the headquarters building and parked. Almost immediately, a trim, efficient-looking colonel with jet-black hair and ice-cold blue eyes got out from behind the wheel. For a brief moment, she stood with her hands on her hips, surveying the area with a disdainful expression. The black and gold patch on her right sleeve showed the medieval helmet and crosssword and marshal's baton of Russia's general staff. A big, beefy man wearing a dark black civilian suit climbed out behind her. His broad, clean-shaven face was harder to read. Every building in sight had dirty windows and peeling paint. Trash cans stacked beside them were full to overflowing. Gravel walkways were rutted and unraked. At first glance, the Spetsnaz compound looked almost completely deserted. Apparently, most of the brigade's officers and men were away for the weekend or off duty for other reasons.
It seems our information was correct, Colonel Irina Zakharova said to her companion.
She shook her head in disbelief.
If this is what passes for an elite unit, I should hate to see what the ragtag conscript force looks like. My aged grandmother and two of her arthritic friends could take this place over without breaking a sweat.
Thoughtfully, the big man nodded.
Perhaps, Colonel, but I suggest we find just how deep the rot goes before coming to any firm conclusions. After all, appearances can be deceiving.
True enough,
she agreed with a faint smile. Together, they trotted up the steps, entered the headquarters building, and strode briskly toward the security desk blocking the front wall. The senior sergeant on duty rose to his feet as soon as they came through the door. Andrei Izayev, a hard-bitten veteran of combat in Chechnya, Ukraine, and Poland, frowned slightly. He knew trouble when he saw it, and these two looked like trouble. Wiping the frown off his face, he threw a quick, precise salute to the woman colonel.
How may I help you, sir?
He said politely.
We want to see the officer of the day, she snapped. Immediately.
Without delay, Izayev picked up a phone and relayed her demand to his immediate superior, Captain Dmitry Leonov. Moments later, the captain, who looked absurdly young for his rank, appeared, hurriedly buttoning his uniform jacket and then straightening his tie. From his rumpled look, he'd probably been caught napping after a heavy lunch in the mess. Swallowing hard, he straightened to attention.
Welcome to the 22nd Guards Spetsnaz Brigade, Colonel.
Wordlessly, the two strangers exchanged disgusted looks and then showed the young officer their identification cards. He stared at them in surprise.
My name is Zakharova,
the colonel told him coldly.
I am assigned to the main army command,
she indicated the big man at her side.
This is Oleg Solomon. He works for the Ministry of Defense in the Financial Inspectorate. Our orders are to conduct a snap inspection of your brigade's personal records, equipment inventory, and other relevant files.
If anything, her expression grew even icier.
Your unit's most recent readiness reports have been found to be highly unsatisfactory, Captain.
Her voice hardened.
And I must inform you that the Ministry and the General Staff are not at all pleased by this sorry state of affairs.
Oh, shit, Leonov thought. With his commanding officer on leave in St. Petersburg, he was the one in the hot seat here. And if there were a worse time for Moscow to start poking its nose into the brigade's internal activities and readiness, he could not imagine when that might be.
Recently promoted from lieutenant, Leonov had been transferred to the Spetsnaz unit from a regular motorized rifle battalion only weeks before, but already he could tell that things were in a bad state. Too many key officer billets were either vacant or filled by greenhorns like him. Except for a couple of diehards like Sergeant Azayev, the same thing could be said about the brigade's enlisted ranks. Everyone at Bataevsk seemed to be just going through the motions, with little evidence of rigorous standards of physical fitness, marksmanship, and discipline he'd been assured were the hallmarks of Russia's vaunted Spetsnaz troops. He gulped.
"Don't just stand there gawping at me like some useless peasant, Captain," Zakharova said. Her voice cracked like a whip. "Are you prepared to cooperate with this inspection, or not?"
Desperately, Leonov fell back on the military courtesies pounded into him as a fledgling officer cadet. He threw his shoulders back, stiffened to rigid attention, and clicked his heels together.
"Of course, Colonel. I will do whatever is necessary to assist you." "Fortunately for us, and I suspect for you, that will not be much," Zakharova said, with thinly veiled amusement. "For now, all we require is access to your database and an office to work in."
Thoroughly cowed now, Leonov escorted them down the hall to the small room set aside for the officer of the day. With a muttered apology, he swept the old newspapers and tabloid magazines stacked next to his computer screen and keyboard into a trash can. From the disgusted sneer on her attractive face, Zakharova probably thought he would have been boning up on weapons and tactics manuals instead. Sweating, he brought the computer screen to life and typed in his user ID and password.
"Good,"
the colonel said flatly. She jerked her head toward the door.
"Now you can go, Captain Leonov."
Her eyes flashed.
"But don't go far. Depending on what we find in your unit's records, we may have more questions for you."
Nervously, Leonov checked his watch. The two bigwigs from Moscow had been locked away inside his office for almost an hour. He wished he had some clearer idea of how much longer they would be there. He supposed it depended on how far back in time they were digging into the brigade's files. Like all organized armies around the world, Russia's ground forces made a fetish of record-keeping. You wanted a new rifle or pair of boots?
"Fill out requested form, Corporal."
"Going on leave to visit your family?"
"File your requests with the appropriate channels, Sergeant."
"Organizing a training exercise for your platoon?"
"Complete the necessary requisitions for ammunition, firing range time, and transportation, Lieutenant."
The only difference now was that almost everything was stored in digital form rather than being kept on paper.
"You don't look too happy about this situation, Captain,"
Sergeant Izayev commented quietly from his post at the security desk. Leonov forced a bitter laugh.
"What's there to be happy about?"
He stopped pacing and waved a hand toward his office.
"We both know nothing good can come out of this surprise inspection. If there's a problem, Colonel Andreev may have more to worry about than you,"
the sergeant pointed out, referring to the absent commander of the 22nd Guards Spetsnaz Brigade. Leonov snorted. In a just world, that would be true. Whatever deficiencies this Colonel Zakharova and the accountant Solomon turned up ought to be laid squarely at the feet of Andreev and his battalion commanders, not pinned on someone like him, a freshly minted and very junior captain. Unfortunately, justice was not usually a concept associated with Russia's armed forces. If Moscow was really pissed off, the brigade commander was going to be hunting around for scapegoats. And blame, like raw sewage, always flowed downhill. And even if Andreev went down instead, nobody on his staff could hope to escape being tarnished by the same aura of sloth, incompetence, and possible corruption.
"No matter how this plays out in the end, one thing's for sure. I'm royally fucked, Sergeant,"
he said gloomily.
"Well, that depends," Izayev said slowly.
Surprised, the captain looked up.
"Depends on what? On whether those two really are who they say they are," the sergeant replied.
Leonov stared at him. While he'd been moaning about his fate, Izayev had obviously been thinking very different thoughts.
"Zakharova and Solomon? Who else could they be?
I don't know, sir. The sergeant lowered his voice even more. But their arrival sure seems conveniently timed to avoid awkward questions. I mean, here we are on the weekend with all our senior officers away, and then bang, two total strangers storm in, flashing identity cards and demanding access to all our files. He shrugged. Doesn't that seem sort of odd to you?
Well, that's the whole point of a surprise inspection, Leonov argued, to catch people off their guard.
Maybe in books, sir,
Izayev said patiently.
But that's not the way the game is usually played.
See, higher-ups like Colonel Andreev almost always have pals or connections on the staff who give them a little friendly warning, quiet-like, about things like this before they happen. The system's set up so that nobody gets embarrassed and everybody looks good.
He swung around in his chair to glance carefully down the hall.
All of which makes me wonder who these people really work for.
Leonov felt cold.
You think they're foreign spies?
Maybe,
the sergeant hesitated. Or they could be some of our own spooks.
His mouth tightened.
Those rat bastards in the GRU or the FSB might be running a no-warning security exercise on us. If so, letting them poke around in our databases isn't going to look too good.
He looked back at the captain.
Either way, sir, you'd better check up on these people.
For what felt like an eternity, Leonov stood frozen.
My God,
he thought, fighting down a rising sense of dread. Izayev was right. His situation was bad enough if this were just a genuine probe into the brigade's records. If, instead, it turned out that he'd given spies, whether foreign or domestic, unchallenged access to their computer systems, he was a dead man walking. Unless, that was, he could find out for sure in time to stop whatever they were doing.
The colonel has a direct link to the Ministry of Defense in his office, the sergeant reminded him. Yes, that's right,
Leonov realized abruptly. He shook himself like a sleeper throwing off a nightmare.
Make sure those two don't leave until I confirm their identities, Sergeant.
Izayev nodded. The veteran Spetsnaz non-com's eyes were expressionless.
No problem, Captain.
With that, Leonov spun on his heel and hurried away down the hall. Inside the captain's office, the big man who called himself Oleg Solomon sat in front of the computer, rapidly scanning through files and then copying them onto a special ultra-high-speed USB flash drive.
How's it going?
His companion asked. Zaharova leaned casually on one corner of the desk, keeping her eye on the door.
Almost finished, he grunted.
Her smartphone buzzed once. She fished it out of her uniform jacket.
Yes. You've got trouble, Sam.
The lilting Welsh voice of David Jones, their backup man, told her.
Someone on that base just placed a secure call to Moscow, to the Ministry of Defense. I doubt that's a coincidence.
Samantha Kerr frowned. Understood, she said. We're pulling out now. She looked across at Marcus Cartwright, her fellow Cyan field operative. We're blown, or in the process of being blown.
That's unfortunate.
The big man replied calmly,
but not wholly unexpected.
With quick, economical movements, he detached the USB drive and slipped it into his own coat. Then he got up and moved toward the door, taking the lead. The hard-faced Spetsnaz sergeant who just greeted them stood waiting in the hallway right outside.
Going somewhere, Mr. Solomon?
He asked Cartwright with a mocking smile.
So soon?
The big man offered him a polite smile and nodded.
The colonel and I have finished our work, Sergeant Izayev. You should be glad to get this out of your hair.
Smoothly, the Russian unholstered a 9mm Udav pistol.
If you are who you claim to be, you have my apologies.
His smile turned uglier.
But if you are what I suspect, your next of kin will have my condolences.
Ashen-faced with fear, Cartwright sagged to his knees. He raised his hands. They were visibly trembling.
Please, this isn't what you think.
Words spilled out of his slack mouth in an almost incoherent jumble.
Really, I swear, we are not...
Shot twice by Samantha Kerr at point-blank range with a tiny Russian-made PSS pistol, the sergeant stumbled backward. He slid down the wall, smearing bright red blood across dingy white paint. His mouth opened for one last desperate cry. And then Marcus Cartwright lunged upward, crushing his trachea with one powerful hammer blow. Working swiftly, the two Cyan agents dragged the corpse back into Leonov's office and dumped it behind his desk.
Well, that's annoying,
Sam said politely, reloading her little pistol. Originally developed by the Soviets for use in covert assassinations by KGB agents and Spetsnaz operatives, though its slow-moving 7.62 subsonic rounds were almost useless beyond 25 meters, the weapon was almost perfectly silent.
I hate it when the opposition wakes up just a bit too soon.
In the brigade commander's much larger and better furnished office not far down the hall, Captain Leonov was on the phone. Grimly he listened to the dry, disinterested voice of the personnel clerk he'd finally been able to reach. Finding someone at the Ministry of Defense who was willing and able to answer his questions had taken much longer than he'd hoped.
Colonel Zakharova? Irina Zakharova, the clerk said. Yes, there is such an officer attached to the general staff. She is on medical leave, or so my records indicate. Apparently she had suffered a mild heart attack last month. Why do you ask?
Leonov clutched the phone tighter. He had been tricked.
Because she...
Behind him, the door into the office swung silently open. Sam Kerr leaned around the doorframe with her pistol in hand, and a look of intense concentration on her face. Coolly, she squeezed the trigger twice. Hit by both shots, Dmitri Leonov crumpled across the desk. The phone dropped out of his hand. Cartwright scooped it up.
This is Senior Sergeant Izayev.
Izayev? What's going on there? Where's your captain?
The clerk in Moscow asked, obviously puzzled.
And what is this business about Colonel Zakharova?
Apparently we have an imposter on the base, Cartwright explained. Captain Leonov is taking a squad to deal with the situation immediately, but he wishes me to thank you for your extremely valuable assistance.
Then, without waiting for a reply, he hung up. The big man looked at Sam.
That's torn it. I'd estimate we have about 30 minutes before all hell breaks loose here. Probably less.
She nodded.
I'm on it.
Taking out her smartphone, she tapped a one-word text message.
Damocles. The request for an emergency extraction.
Message sent, her phone reported. 10. Headquarters, Southern Military District, Rostov-on-Don, Russia. A couple of hours later. The Southern Military District had its headquarters in a 5-story neoclassical building in downtown Rostov. If it weren't for the iron rail fence and small white guard post blocking access to a door bearing the double-headed eagle emblem of Russia's armed forces, passers-by would ordinarily have thought it just another luxury apartment building, art gallery, store, or bank. No one could have made that mistake now. Armed soldiers in camouflaged battle dress and body armor patrolled the neighboring streets. Police cars barricaded every major intersection. Staff officers streamed into the building in twos and threes, summoned back to duty by emergency phone calls to suburban homes and country dachas. One by one, lights flickered on behind tall curtained windows on every floor. Short and stocky, still built like the tank commander he had once been, Colonel General Vladislav Nikitin stormed into the crowd operations center in a foul temper. It was irritating enough that this sudden emergency had ruined a delightful romp with his newest mistress, a beautiful blonde soap opera actress, arriving to find his staff scurrying around in what appeared at first glance to be a total confusion was worse. Everywhere he turned, phones were ringing off the hook, cigarettes smoldered in overflowing ashtrays, and throughout the room, groups of officers clustered around maps, gesturing wildly while they argued about which units should be deployed where. Scowling, Nikitin shoved past them, ignoring their startled looks and frantic salutes. He found his chief of staff, Major General Maxim Borovkov, hunched over a map of his own.
This one showed the entire region around Rostov, stretching from Ukraine and the Sea of Azov in the west to Georgia and Azerbaijan in the south, and the Caspian Sea and Kazakhstan to the east. Even Barovkov, tall, wiry, and ordinarily as cool as ice, looked ruffled.
"How bad is this?"
Nikitin demanded.
"Pretty bad,"
his chief of staff admitted. He pointed at Batesk.
"Earlier this afternoon, a captain and sergeant of the 22nd Guards Spetsnaz Brigade were murdered, gunned down inside the headquarters building there. Their bodies were discovered after a Ministry of Defense official reported receiving a strange, interrupted telephone call from this Captain Leonov. The captain was trying to check up on the identity of two strangers on base, one of whom claimed to be a colonel on the general's staff."
"Sukin sin! Son of a bitch!"
Nikitin muttered. Donning his reading glasses, he glared down at the map.
"So, was this a terrorist attack? Or some sort of espionage operation that went wrong?"
Barovkov didn't hesitate. Probably the latter. The sentries at the gate confirmed there were only two visitors during the time in question, a man and a woman. Both had what seemed valid identification papers. From what we can tell, these people drove straight to the 22nd headquarters, spent roughly an hour inside, and then left. Searches haven't turned up any evidence they planted explosives or other devices, as one would expect terrorists to do.
Nikitin nodded, thinking that over. The other man's assessment made sense. But what in the hell could spies have been looking for at Batysk? The Spetsnaz units based there hadn't seen active service in the short abortive war with Poland 3 years ago. Why target them now?
"The local police have found the vehicle the attackers used. A Gaz Patriot SUV, abandoned several kilometers away," Barovkov continued.
"So they've switched cars?"
"Quite probably," Barovkov agreed. He shrugged. "Unfortunately, we don't have any description of their other vehicle. The police haven't yet been able to find any witnesses who saw the switch."
"Better and better, Maxim,"
Nikitin said acidly. He took off his reading glasses, closed his eyes for a moment, and pinched the bridge of his nose. He could feel a headache threatening to develop.
"So, what is being done to find these enemy agents?" "All airports, railway stations, bus terminals, and border patrol points are on high alert," Barovkov reported. "We also established roadblocks on all major highways and secondary roads leading out of Batysk and Rostov."
"Who's manning these roadblocks?"
"Mostly the local police," Barovkov said. "I've ordered more troops flown in from the 7th Guards Mountain Air Assault Division and the 76th Guards Airborne Brigade, but they won't arrive for several more hours."
Sourly, Nikitin nodded. Unfortunately, most of his active duty army units were scattered widely across the vast southern military district, either on occupation duty in eastern Ukraine and the Crimea, or guarding the border with Georgia and Azerbaijan. Aside from the 22nd Guards Spetsnaz Brigade itself, his immediately available forces were limited to a relative handful of military police troops and a few motor rifle platoons detached from their parent units to act as guards for key installations in and around Rostov.
"Get those paratroops here as fast as possible," he ordered. "I want a solid cordon around Rostov and Batysk before dawn tomorrow. Let's try to pin these spies close to the city. Then, if necessary, we can send in our soldiers to go house to house hunting them."
"Yes, sir. And tell the air defense forces I want every SAM regiment in this area at maximum readiness. Then contact the airbase at Kryminsk. I want some of our Su-27 fighters aloft as soon as they can be armed, fueled, and made ready."
Barovkov raised an eyebrow.
"Do you think someone will try to fly the enemy agents out?"
Nikitin shrugged.
"Hell if I know. But now that we know we have burglars prowling around, let's not make the mistake of leaving the windows open."
Sion 6, over southern Russia. Later that night. Beneath scattered clouds, isolated points of light marked the small towns and villages dotting a darkened landscape. This part of southern Russia was mostly farmland. Even with spring planting well underway, many fields still lay fallow.
In the distance, off to the northeast, the city lights of Rostov-on-Don glowed pale yellow on the horizon. With Major Nadia Rozek piloting from the right-hand seat, a specially modified PZL-SW-4 light helicopter skimmed low over the ground, heading east at nearly 100 knots. Called the Pushchik, or Tawny Owl, by its Polish designers,